I'm very, very happy, having no idea what's going to happen tomorrow or today or 10 minutes from now. And learning that and trusting and having, I guess, the kind of faith or kind of confidence. It's a kind of just like, things work, you know? And if you know that, you're able to see the right ring to grasp. You're able to see the step, like that Indiana Jones movie from a zillion years ago. You see the step kind of showing up in front of you when it's time to take it. Instead of needing to know 4 years in advance where you're going to be in, you know, 2013, and how, you know, what clothes you're wearing and what your hat looks like and, you know, who you're married to and all sort of stuff. It's extremely present focused. It's extremely just like, here I am today. And most people, I think, just do not want that.
You are listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
On today's episode of Hooked on Startups, I am delighted beyond words to be joined by none other than Dave Goodman. Dave, welcome to Hooked on Startups.
Thank you. Pleasure.
People normally say more at this stage, but don't worry. We can.
It's such a beautiful day. Nope, I got nothing.
That's too much.
Okay.
Dave, you are a musical prodigy. You are an entrepreneur. You're a pilot. But most importantly, you are the inventor of the Coco Jack. Now, would you care to explain to my viewer who and what the Coco Jack is?
Sure. The Coco Jack is a tool that opens coconuts safely in seconds, no matter your size or strength. And our company sells an entire line of coconut products to open, scoop, sip, and noodle fresh coconuts.
Have you been asked this question before?
Once or twice, yeah.
Let me see your fingers. How many fingers do you have?
I've got all of them. I can't say that for all of our customers, though. Yeah.
And that is that the main reason? So were you born into this profession of inventing devices to open coconuts?
As a matter of fact, yeah, I come from a long line of coconut opening. No, I don't. Yeah. I was keen on inventing stuff when I was a kid, and I didn't really have the channels for it. So it wasn't until like 2012, I guess, I sold my apartment in New York City so I could travel full time, that I had the extra cash to play around with developing these tools. But yeah, I was a classical musician for years and years and years and years, and didn't want to cut my fingers opening coconuts. And so I thought there's got to be a better way to do this, which I think is the magic line everyone gets in their head. So yeah, after I sold my apartment in 2012, I bought four of these so I could travel full time. And I had one in three different cities so I could have a house everywhere around the US. And when I got down to Austin, Texas, I met a blacksmith who also had a big red beard. So I kind of knew it was fate. And we started making prototypes, and it took 100 prototypes to get it right. And now it works basically perfectly. And in the early days, you know, I did very well with my apartment sales, so I had a little extra money to play with. And I would tell myself, well, I don't know if this will work or not, you know, but I want to have fun and learn something every day. Those were my goals in the early days. And so every day I would learn something. Every day I would have fun, you know, playing around with coconuts and these crazy, they look like torture devices. If you see them, they're on our website, on the Discovering the Coco Jack page. These freaky looking tools that just didn't work at all. And the process of discovering it over, you know, weeks and months was really fun. It was absolutely fun. And it turns out it did work.
I mean, but going back, so you talk about being a classical musician. You were a musical prodigy. So you went to the Juilliard School in New York.
Yeah, when I was in pre-college for Juilliard, then I went to Curtis for college, which was like a tiny sort of hyper elite creme de la creme place that no one's heard of. But it's in classical music, it's quite well known.
And this was, I guess, sort of 20 years or so, but then you founded the Wild Ginger Philharmonic. So just as a bit of context, for those of you who are listening as opposed to watching, Dave is about 19 feet tall, has this enormous red beard, and it looks like this, you know, huge giant of a man. So the Wild Ginger Philharmonic obviously has something to do with that, I would imagine.
You know what? It's actually funny. At the time, I was unfamiliar with the term ginger, and I was much less ginger. Well, I was still gingery in those days, but we were actually looking, the guy I did my first concert with, we were actually looking in the dictionary. We were trying to name the orchestra, and we thought, oh, the Samson Street Symphony, the South Street Symphony, and then he opened the dictionary, and he said, oh, we should call something that begins with X, like the X, and there was nothing. The X-ray Symphony, the Xenophobe Symphony didn't work, and he flipped the page, and there was a picture of Wild Ginger in the dictionary, and he said, well, we call it Wild Ginger, Dave. And I said, yeah, that's perfect, the Wild Ginger Philharmonic. So that really it's a catchy name for the
but it got rave reviews as well. So clearly there was something really different that you were doing when you were.
Yeah, I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneur back then, but I, you know, I founded the orchestra myself and, you know, produced the concerts and conducted everything. And so I guess that's what you do, except in the nonprofit world. Yeah, no, I was very disappointed with the options that were available as a classical musician at the time. There's low job satisfaction. There's not a lot of a lot of classical musicians, especially orchestra musicians, are very unhappy. And it's just kind of a joyless, you know, it's joyful when you're young, and then the profession wasn't very satisfying. So I wanted to start an orchestra that where the musicians were engaged, where the concerts were actually really compelling. People weren't sort of faking through the concerts like they typically do in classical music. And so we would, I would basically kidnap about, you know, 50 or 60 young musicians, take them out to the country where they couldn't dodge rehearsals. And we'd do, you know, 15 or 20 rehearsals or more for a concert instead of three. And we'd memorize whole pieces, the whole orchestra would memorize a piece, and we'd sort of stand up and play together. And we'd teach the audiences like an opera duet and then accompany the audience singing it during intermission. And it was really just a very engaging experience. I was always very proud to say we had, you know, blue-haired old ladies and blue-haired teenagers in the audience as
Fantastic.
Well. And it was really fun. I just burnt out really hard after maybe five or six seasons. It was just, yeah.
And I think that's part of the story as well, isn't it? It was that burnout. It was that, because what you were doing is something completely different. So the approach, it was a very entrepreneurial approach that you took to, it wasn't just playing. As you said, you were engaging people, you were memorizing pieces, and the write-ups that you got in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal were fantastic write-ups. So there was something really different. So, and then the burnout, what happened then? Was it just...
I was getting sick a lot. I was sick in bed probably 1 week a month for over a year. And I didn't know how to manage the success. I didn't know how to manage, you know, the backbiting. I didn't know how to manage my health at that time. And I saw the trajectory. So many musicians or artists or actors, they kind of have that 27, they head towards 27 and then they just implode, you know, and that's a pretty typical pattern for many people. And I saw that trajectory for myself. And, you know, for better or for worse, I sort of pulled back from the brink. I said, you know, I need to sort this stuff out if I'm going to have an extended career in anything, or I might not make it till 30, like, again, so many young artists. So I pulled back, moved to California to try to get my health together. It sort of worked. And at that time, I developed a real love for economics and business, but mainly economics, and then wanted to participate in that. And then, sorry, you sound like you want to get a word in.
No. I was just looking. So you mentioned economics, but I was just looking. It's actually not economics on its own. It's economics, neuro-linguistic programming, hypnosis, mythology, aviation. So you know, for you, taking time off is not taking time off. It's
that's true. Yeah,
immersing yourself in about every ology there is known to man.
Thank you. Yeah, that's true. I'm kind of an autodidact, and I get bored easily, and I'm very curious about things. And I like to try to make sense. Well, in this case, it was sort of youthful philosophical stuff, trying to make sense of the world, you know, intellectually, spiritually, emotionally. And for me, you know, I studied all kinds of California meditation-y things for a long time. And really, economics was, for me, the missing piece that kind of made sense of everything that I didn't like or understand about the world, but made it logical to me in a way I could accept. So it became sort of part of my philosophical development as much as anything.
How did you, and where did you study this? I mean, was this self-study or did you go to?
Yeah, self-study. School doesn't work that well for me. It's usually too slow and too organized. I sort of immerse myself in things and I read, and one thing leads to another and leads to another and leads to another. At that time, I was very into, there's a company called, it's now called The Great Courses, but it was called a teaching company. This was, you know, back in the Stone Age before everything was free on YouTube. They had these amazing courses in everything from, you know, the Aeneid to American history to Russian history to algebra and calculus. And I loved them. So their economics course was just life-changing for me. Timothy Taylor, who teaches out in Minnesota and is a somewhat well-known blogger, he was teaching this course, and it just all the lights went on, and I was like, wow, this is the missing piece for me. So I became obsessed and read very widely for years and years, and then eventually I wanted to participate, because in classical music, you know, you're in the nonprofit world, so it's a whole different world. And actually, being classical music, I kind of taught myself all of free market economics by being in a culture that was the opposite and seeing how unhappy it made people, seeing how poor it made people, seeing how corrupt it was and how kind of cronyist it was. And I try to figure out why this was, why this career that I loved and this repertoire that I loved was so difficult to find fulfillment through professionally. And I just kept thinking about it back at the time. And now when I started studying economics, I saw, well, that's what I was discovering, was these sort of classic economic principles being misapplied or being fought against in my old industry. And that's what led to predictable results of people being really underpaid and unhappy and frustrated. So it's redeeming, but sad at the same time to see it played out so graphically.
And is that, I mean, just to follow this thread for a bit, because I guess the story with musicians is that this should be a vocation. You shouldn't expect to be paid. You should just love what you do. You're enriching people's lives. Is that not enough? And is that, that seems like it's a Stone Age philosophy that has perpetuated for some reason. Is there something there that you can change? Do you see yourself coming back and reinventing the way that people are involved in music?
Yeah, I mean, and I was a believer in that for much of my youth. And in a way, it is. You sacrifice your childhood in a way for art. You don't make normal friends. You don't go to normal life. Most people are sort of weird geniuses who are prodigy, dancers, musicians. They start very young, actors. They start very young. It's very abnormal lives. And you do kind of sacrifice a degree of normalcy and often a degree of prosperity. And at some point when I was in school, I don't know, I just got tired of it. I thought that you can do this without having to suffer, that there was a sort of weird dignity, especially in classical music, about the sort of suffering artist and the unhappy genius and so forth. And I thought, you know what, I don't want to be that. I want to be a great musician, but I don't want to be joyless and miserable, or even leverage the kind of the romanticism of the joylessness. And it's definitely an archetypal mythological pattern. I mean, it's been around the kind of starving artist forever. And, some of the greatest musicians, I remember reading somewhere, the greatest writer in the world is some guy who sits in his basement somewhere typing up these incredible novels and no one ever reads them because no one knows who he is. He's got no business sense. He has no promotional sense. There's no way to find out who he is. And the world is filled with mediocre artists who are famous. And I'd like to think that somewhere in between, there's a way to fuse the business acumen and the success mindset with actual mastery of your craft and your art so that the world benefits from it. And I think it's unique, or a modern phenomenon, how to fit that into the modern American open market system, which in classical music was built in the monarchic period, when you had a wealthy patron, everything was very centralized. It was not democratic. It was, it was a different financial system than we live in now, and a different cultural system where you could have nationalistic Russian music or nationalistic French music that was very identified with your culture. But that doesn't work here because Americans were mutts, and so that you can't sort of play a Brahms symphony and sell out because, oh, this is a great part of our heritage, because it's not. But you could take a universal principle, which is much more American, and say, this music just sounds really good. If you play it well, if you play it with the meaning that's in the piece and you rehearse it properly so you convey the beauty and what's meant to be communicated, it can communicate to anybody. You don't have to be German or French or Italian. And that was sort of the tack I took at the time. But fitting the economic part of it and the success part of it into the American system, it's an adjustment, certainly for classical music. I think pop music does it very well, although that certainly has lots of problems too, but they're different problems.
I mean, do you think, and also with the rise of different payment methods, so, we hear every day about more and more cryptocurrencies and more automated or digital payment mechanisms.
Yeah.
Do you think that is going to change the way that people can be paid? So, And do you think that will create a renaissance in classical music because people will be able to be compensated for their for the joy and for the creativity that they bring?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, classical music, I haven't been playing in that world for a minute, so I don't know. I'm not up to date on its trials and tribulations today. But I think you're right. I think even just the internet alone opens up all kinds of avenues for revenue, even if it's just PayPal, even if you're not using crypto. But I mean, the next 20 years would be fascinating. I mean, but even in pop music, it was similar. It was very cartelized, if that's the right word, with the big record labels for a long time. But there have been huge indie rock band successes in the past 20 years that just had, MySpace followings or now Facebook followings. And they're able to really succeed on their terms with a big enough crowd to feed and clothe them or much more using those technologies. I think it's a question for the artist of what you said before of getting the right mindset and actually wanting that. That if there is a romance in the kind of starving artist thing, that not everybody wants to shake, and that you maybe feel like you're contaminating your art or so forth if you do make any money off of it. Sort of undermines the vocational nature, like you said. And if people still have that mindset, it doesn't matter what the technology is, they're going to be poor and probably unhappy. And so they have to sort of decide. But even that kind of thinking is permeating more and more. All this sort of, what is it, The Secret, and kind of, you know, well, even NLP, yeah. That kind of thinking has kind of penetrated more of the normal culture also. So I would expect it to be changing. I hope so. You know, I think that, yeah.
But I was going to say, with what you're doing with Coco Jack, that's creativity as well. Music is creativity. Entrepreneurialism is creativity. So is Coco Jack, is that an outlet? Is that something that enabled you to solve those issues that you were facing with music? Is music parked forever, or is it something that you're going to revisit?
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's parked forever by any means. And as a conductor, I'm still quite young anyway. So I don't feel like I'm at a huge disadvantage in terms of that. But no, there's definitely a lot of creativity and entrepreneurship. Part of my challenge is disciplining myself where I don't create 500 products and, you know, have all this complication. Whereas focusing on a select few products and doing that extremely well, that's been the goal for the business. And it's been a challenge because I do like the creative aspect. I mean, we do marketing materials. I work a ton with my artists for making pitch decks or making proposals or whatever for different events and things like that. And that's definitely a fun creative outlet, but it's channeled, you know, maybe 15-20% creativity, 80% business. And I remember when I started, when I was inventing the tools, that was all creativity. It was fun. I had extra money to play with. So I said, well, let's just play. And, you know, if it works, it works. And we didn't know if it would work or not. You know, I asked a bunch of engineers. I said, well, why isn't this working? And they said, well, we don't know. It's coconuts. There's no science on this, you know. And so a lot of it was trial and error and kind of inspiration and so forth. That was totally creative. And I think at one point I said, okay, the tools are created, because I was also aware there's lots of sort of great tinkerers and inventors. Similar to a guy typing the book in his basement. They've got these great ideas, but they don't know how to bring them to market. They don't know how to mass produce them, how to market them, how to run a business. And they're these kind of, you know, kooky, weird, brilliant engineers who can't interface with the world enough to make their vision a reality. And so I remember at a certain point, I sort of made a conscious switch. I said, okay, I'm an inventor, fine, but I'm no longer inventing Coco Jack. I'm running the business of Coco Jack. And it was a business. Yeah.
What sort of help did you have? So it sounds like a lot of this stuff was done on your own, but were there people around you that you could rely on? Because you've moved completely away from the industry that you were in. I think you went on tell us a story about how, you know, why coconuts in the first place?
Oh yeah. Well, part of getting my health back together after, you know, the real burnout, was I discovered the raw food diet. A friend of mine, I'd gone away when I was in flight school. I was in middle America eating America food for a year, and I got very overweight and unhealthy. And I was going to the gym every day, but it wasn't working. I wasn't getting healthier. And I was like, you know, this is what happens in my, you know, mid-20s, and you start this sort of slow decline towards, you know, death and whatever, despair. And I said, well, I'm not really ready for that. I've got a lot of stuff I want to do. And when I got back to Newark, an old friend of mine who was in his 60s at the time, I hadn't seen him in 2 years. He looked fantastic. I said, wow, you lost 20 pounds. Your skin is glowing. They had to take out his colon, but then they didn't have to take out his colon. I said, well, what are you doing? Because you look great. Yeah. And he gave me this green juice to drink. And I said, well, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to drink it. And I got sick right away from a cleansing, like a detox reaction. Was sick for 2 weeks, probably lost 30 pounds in a month or two. Yeah. Drinking this stuff, you know, sweating, my skin cleared up, my mind cleared up. It was just an amazing transformation. Lost about 100 pounds over a year doing just detoxing, cleansing, you know, a little bit of fasting and just eating raw foods and a lot of green stuff, and changed my life. So coconuts were kind of a staple of that diet. So I was throwing a knife at my hands, you know, 5-10 times a day for weeks on end. And I thought, well, you know, if I do ever want to go back to music, this is a great way to not do it. If I slice off one of my fingers, so
you could presumably you could find limited pieces where the range of notes that you needed to play was.
Well, I mean, what is the Django Reinhardt, the two finger guitar player? So it's certainly doable. I'm not sure I want that to be my legacy, but
yeah, you'd have a limited repertoire, but still.
Yeah, you get a lot of good PR though for the two fingered pianist or whatever. That's a good PR play, but not for me.
But that was it. So that's, and the aha moment, I guess. So as you were throwing your machetes and, you know, various
levers,
levers and hammers and all sorts of things, you know, I mean, I know because it is particularly the Thai coconuts, because they are sort of armor plated and you have to drive over them with a truck or something to
get inside. Yeah. No, they're the best tasting ones, and they're the kind of classic raw food coconut. They have a slightly sweet flavor. And back in the day, in World War One, the water was actually used for blood transfusions. It's so similar to human plasma. Our lawyers won't let us recommend that to people, but it's it was something that was done for just consult your doctor before you put coconut in your
before
vein.
You but, use yeah. this as a blood transfusion. Exactly. I'll make sure that that's in the show notes.
Yeah, lots of disclaimers there, but they're fantastic and delicious, and you know, fresh coconuts are the best.
But the real issue is, and so that's a typical example of a market problem. So as opposed to being an inventor, as you were saying earlier, just inventing stuff for the hell of it, the difference is this is a real problem. This is a problem on a grand scale. So you're not just creating a nice to have. That you know, so real risk, massive demand. Yeah. So was there a moment where you thought there must be some device out there that I can use, and then you found that there was nothing?
I mean, that was sort of the way people did it. I mean, I looked around a little bit and it was obvious that there was no real good solution for it. And then at least nothing like I had in envisioned. It's funny because at the time I thought my market was just the kind of like Venice Beach raw food, hippie vegans, you know, maybe I'd sell 10, 20,000 of them and, you know, call it a day. But as I tested it with people to see if they would actually want to buy it, you know, for the money I was going to charge, I would realize, oh no, it's a lot of people. And every inventor thinks that their product, oh, it's for everybody, and they're usually wrong. And I thought it was, you know, just for a few people, but I was wrong. You know, it was really, there's people eat coconuts everywhere. And we've very, very, very diverse customer base, which is really exciting.
And how did you start the process? So did your sort of creativity genes kick in when you were thinking, how do we build this? How do we design it?
Yeah, I mean, with starting this company, I had a little bit to prove to myself in terms of what you needed to start a company. You know, pretty much, I didn't want to think you had to have the right connections and know all the right people for it. I wanted to sort of do it with what was right in front of me. You know, I had a friend who was an artist, and I described what I was in thinking, and he drew on a piece of paper, and it was close enough. And I said, okay, well, I don't know anything about metal. I guess the blacksmiths make metal, don't they? And so I looked in the phone book or the internet, and oh, there's this blacksmith. So I went and visited him, and I said, okay, well, you know, can you do this for me? Here's the picture. And I knew enough to get a non-disclosure. I read up about patent stuff like that to make sure that I did it all properly. And you know, really just put one foot in front of the other. And I won't say I pride myself in not knowing anything, but I have no ego invested in being a great metal worker or anything like that, or a great marketer. I just didn't know anything. So I asked a lot of questions. I talked to a lot of people, and I just asked. And I'm like, I would say I played dumb. I said I probably was dumb. I just didn't know. And most people are very, very happy to share their knowledge with you, because most of them really cares. And then someone shows up and wants to know, and they won't stop talking, you know, and it's great. They're very eager. And, you know, you hear, I took the tool around my prototype to, you know, 5 or 10 manufacturers, and every one of them knows the right way to do it, and it's their way to do it, and they're all different. And so I have to sort of take all that back and process it and say, well, what makes the most sense for us? Can we combine these? You know, don't take anybody too seriously with what they know, but listen to them and hear what they have to say. So for me, I've approached it from a point of discovery and learning rather than a prefab plan. This is how you do it. So it's kind of, you know, sort of follow the yellow brick road kind of thing and see where it goes, instead of knowing start to finish what it's going to look like and how this all works, because I've made 60 kitchen tools before.
So. But I think that's probably the best way though, isn't it? Because if you go in without any preconceptions and you work on the basis that I've got this idea, but I need help, is that the advice that you would you do it the same way next time around, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I probably would do it faster, and I'd get more help. I wanted this experience of filling in all the blanks and teaching myself. You know, I've taught, you know, patent law, trademark law, all about marketing, import, export, distribution, you know, the whole how everything works, including all the things that are probably ripe for disruption too. And for me, it was very satisfying. I mean, it may be faster to come in with a team who's done it all before, but then you're running a different kind of company. And I think part of the reason Coco Jack has taken on so well is there is a kind of grassrootsiness to it. There's a, I don't know, I'm always surprised at the loyalty of the people, how much they love our products. And I'm not surprised anymore, but it's amazing that
it's a story. It's the fact, it's all about this. It's all about the challenge that you went through. It's all about the, you know, the fact that you weren't just gifted this, the fact that you had to stumble your way through and you went through 100 different prototypes, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things you learn is, I mean, for me, what I love about entrepreneurship and why I think everyone should think like an entrepreneur, no matter whether you're a secretary or a student or anything, you should think like an entrepreneur because I just lost my train of thought. just thinking.
I was saying that you did 100 different.
Oh yeah, right. That's what, and one of the things you do is you don't know, but you're going to keep up and keep doing it again tomorrow. That's almost the only skill you really need for this is to not be discouraged because there'll be plenty of things to discourage you. Oh, this doesn't work. Never mind. I give up, you know, and I could have done that after prototype 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 9, you know, and that's okay. Never mind. But you get up again and you say, you know, you back off a bit, think about it, try something new. And, you know, most of the real breakthroughs happened kind of randomly. You know, it was maybe someone was using the tool a different way and actually that worked better than what we were doing before. Or, you know, someone said something a while back that we ruled out and, you know, the kind of the inspiration comes. So, but yeah, that's a great way to think of what you do is the persistence and how important that is. And there's a lot of other sort of entrepreneurial skill sets in terms of being flexible and value creation and so forth. But that's a big one. You know, it's the only skill I brought to the table was getting up and doing it again, even when stuff's, you know, especially, you know, when things are hard, you know, you're getting yelled at, you're getting trolled, you're getting, you know, all kinds of threats and whatever. And people, you know, they love you, but they also hate you or they resent you, especially, you know, if you're on TV, there's a lot of sort of envy that comes at you and expectations and, you know, facing that every day can be hard. But it's, if you keep on doing it, that's kind of what works.
And talking about TV, so you, again, had a huge sort of leap forward, I guess, because you, one of your investors is Mark Cuban.
Yeah. We got a handshake with Mark on the show. Yeah, that was, it was a good moment.
But, and again, this, I think you may be slightly underplaying the, you know, months of preparation that went into this.
That's true. Going on Shark Tank is a grueling experience. It was months of preparation. You're right. Months and months of, I watched every single episode of the show. Because I it's funny, when they called me, they said, hey, you know, we want to put you on. You know, you passed all the rounds. They said, well, have you seen the show before? I said, yeah, I think I saw it once before. I'll be fine. They're like, no. You should really watch the show. And I said, okay. So I went on YouTube and I found an episode of the show. And the first one I dug up was this guy from Salt Lake City who had some kind of hot chocolate company. And it was some ancient Mayan hot chocolate recipe or whatever. And he gets there and he gives it out to all the sharks and they all drink it. And all at once, they all spit it out and say, this is disgusting. And I looked at the YouTube screen. I said, there's no fucking way I'm going on that show. You have to be crazy. You know,
well, of course, they probably loved it. It was probably the most delicious chocolate they've ever tasted. But that is good TV.
It's not good TV, right? Nice, warm, fuzzy. No, it was drama. And that's the thing. Their job is to make good television. It's not to help out the, I mean, to an extent, sure. And I got along really well with all the producers, everything. It was, I didn't feel any animosity towards from them at all. But I saw that. I said, well, I'm not doing that. You know, it was terrifying. They can cut it and edit it and you know, who knows what will happen on the show. You have a slip up. And so I was very ambivalent about it for months. But I figured if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it well. I'm going to be as prepared as I can. And so I did. I watched every single episode. I wrote down every question that they asked. And I made sure I had at least 3 answers to every question that they asked. And if I didn't know some, I actually hired sort of a CFO company to coach me on any of the lingo that I might not know. And they sort of challenged me for the stuff and caught me up to speed and, you know, tried to throw me to sort of train me to make sure that I wouldn't have a deer in the headlights moment on the show. And I didn't, you know, as best as I can recall anyway. so yeah, I actually have never really watched it. I think I saw it once by accident, but it was too much to check it out, but it's a grueling experience and it does take months. But now
you've gone through so that was was that a launch pad or was that because you've raised capital through crowdfunding now and you're now working?
We've done a bit with crowdfunding. Most of what we've done has been with debt. I think we did an Indiegogo because of pre-launch and the platform didn't really work for us. So that hasn't been a great platform for us. It probably could be. But I think what needs to get put into it, it's not as great of a fit as it probably should be for us, just because I think of where we are at least right now. But yeah, we did a lot of this. The debt market now is actually terrible for small businesses, which I learned. That's one of the things I learned. It's funny because before I launched, I walked into a Wells Fargo bank and I said, well, hey, you know, Wells Fargo guy, I was like, I'm about to launch a company. I think I'm going to blow up really big. I want to make sure that if we grow up big, you'll be able to lend us money so we can buy inventory. And he said, oh yeah, absolutely. If you can show us those sales, yeah, no problem. And I said, okay, great. That's solid. And then it turns out that's just not true. The banks really don't lend at all to small business. If you have purchase orders, they'll lend, but if you're, we're very successful online, the banking model hasn't caught up with that remotely. And so there's lots of alternative lenders, but it's very expensive and complicated. It's an interesting predicament for a lot of small business.
This is one of the challenges. So it's actually a challenge of success. So it's funny how the irony is layered upon layered. And so the life of an entrepreneur, you go through all the engineering phases, you have this idea, you have the determination and the persistence to turn your idea into reality. You spend months or hundreds of man hours preparing for the performance of a lifetime, effectively, in front of a TV audience. And then when you're successful, then it's, well, we'd love you to be successful, but what we're going to do is we're going to starve you of the oxygen that you need. Yeah. So here's a little bit of money. You either spend it on advertising, get loads of deals that you can't fulfill, or make loads of product that you can't sell because you haven't got the money for advertising. So how did you deal with that that balance?
As well as I could. You're exactly right. One of my advisors who said, the most dangerous thing that can happen to a company that's undercapitalized is success.
Yes.
Because you blow up fast. That's been our problem literally since day one. We've been sold out half the time we've been in business. And getting the funding to stock up on enough inventory to really try and market, it just hasn't been available. And not the amount we need, and certainly not the price that we needed. And then combine it with any kind of hiccups with manufacturing, and you're really, it's a huge stress. And so we've, you just sort of muddle through is the answer. And we're actually in the middle of a much bigger raise now to solve that problem. And that's sort of the answer that I think in this day and age. One of my lending advisors too, he said, if this had been before 2008, no problem. You can have anything you want and no one will even ask for your social security number, But now since the crash, not to be bitter about it, but the big banks are doing just fine, the people who caused the crash. But the small entrepreneurs have really, really gotten the short end of it.
That is a big problem because, raising capital is one of the biggest challenges for entrepreneurs. But what you did is you invested all of your money. So you sold up apartment in New York. That was your capital. And do you feel that there are... Is it a closed shop? The debt market is one thing, banks is another thing. But what advice would you give to people who are trying to, first of all, trying to get their product up to that critical mass,
right?
That critical point where a VC like the guys that you're talking to will say, "Okay, you're now on our radar."
Right, right. It's a trip. I was actually mentoring a guy the other day who was asking about his patent. And he's like, "Look, I have no money, but I need to get my patent started now." And that's a multi-years long process, probably for him a six-figure process. And he hasn't even made a prototype yet, And he should be spending all his money on prototypes, and not on legal fees that may or may not ever pay off ever. That's the predicament that he's with. So there's ways around it. You can be clever in terms of getting a lawyer as an investor, let him or her be a partner and work for you, for free or for a discount or deferred payments or whatever to manage that. You can do crowdfunding, which can work. There's friends and family you can beg, borrow, and steal from, or you give a big chunk of your company to an angel. You find someone who has done it before. And if it's your first venture, you might give up 40% of your company for not a whole lot of money. But if they see progress and you have the right angel, they can support you. But it's that first getting from first year, from a full stop to first, second year, that is the challenge. That's absolutely the challenge. And it depends on your industry, depends on you, what your resources are, but it's a huge challenge.
And the sales that you've made, what has been most successful? You talked about Venice Beach. So I had this imagine you sort of literally going from store to store to store to restaurant to restaurant. But is that what it takes? Is that, how do you get successful at sales?
That's actually where it's easier. I would say it's easy, but for us, we do a ton with Facebook marketing, and in a way that's a technology that levels the playing field considerably and makes, because we actually didn't go from, we're always holding back on sales. I don't do any marketing now because we're backordered right now, but people find us anyway. Initially we were doing Facebook ads and making like a 14x return on our Facebook ads every day when we launched, and it allows you to custom tailor your marketing to exactly who you want. And Facebook, especially doing videos, the pricing, we get 0.001 cents it costs us to watch, 3 seconds of one of our videos, and, maybe a few pennies more to watch the whole thing. That's basically free advertising for us. But we have a very Facebookable, videoable product, a very great, great visual product. And our videos are good. So that helps. I've seen some Facebook ads, you know, for dentists or whatever, and you think, well, okay, you know, next. But for a new and innovative product, I think it's a great, great, great platform.
Is that something that you learned, or is that something that you were advised on? So what advice would you give people that have a product, and how can they get started on Facebook in the most effective way?
I would say you can, there's a ton you can read about online. I mean, the issue with Facebook is they innovate like a startup still. I mean, every time I go back, if I take a few months off, I go back and the whole interface is different. You know, they've got all these new features and so forth. And it's an amazing platform, but it's rapidly changing. So there's some great bloggers who are really keep up on this stuff and advise. They've got good, their commenters are also communities of people who are really smart. But the nice thing is you can do anything for $5. You just take $5 and throw it in there and see what happens, you know, and you get great feedback that way.
And again, but the importance of design, because if you look at the Cocoa Jack website, it's beautifully designed. It's,
thank you.
The branding and the look and feel, it does feel like you're part of a movement, like you're part of a small group of friends and family, as opposed to being a big corporate brand.
Where did
that design come from?
Well, that's actually a really fun story. And I mean, I'm big on just, I think my music background, the performance side and the presentation side, I just think it's so important. You know, no one is going to see all the factory stuff and the legal stuff and the shipping thing and all your freight stuff. Nobody sees that. What they see is the pretty shining face on the front end. And that's how they interact with you. So if that doesn't look good, they're going to be reluctant to interact with you even if your stuff is good. Because you also see really cool products with these dumpy websites. You're like, I don't know about this, you know? Yeah. So it's beyond just the corporate stuff. All right, I'll tell a bit of the story about my logo. I mean, the short version is I had a great idea for a logo. I knew exactly what it should be. And it was this really cool pirate. And I wanted to spend thousands of dollars, not as in a logo, but people were like, oh, Dave, are you Cocoa Jack the pirate? And I was no, no, no. And they said, yes, 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 Dave, you're Cocoa Jack the pirate. I'm like, and eventually I kind of acquiesced. And there's a guy in Venice Beach who's a great, he actually made Johnny Depp's hat for that movie, the pirate movie. And he made me a very expensive but amazing pirate hat. And I said, okay, cool. This is going to be part of their thing. And I met a guy through a friend. He said, Dave, you got to talk to this guy. And actually, his firm, it's one of the proudest things about the whole company. The firm that they work for, they've done some of the most incredible brands of anybody. You know, Guinness, yes. Rich Crackers, and Nordstrom. They're amazing. And he basically said, this isn't going to work, you know. And he convinced me to switch to the brand that we have now. With some tweaks, we've done some tweaks since then, and he was absolutely right. He and his artist we work with, they nailed it for us.
Yes,
and he taught me how to brand properly, how to think of it properly, and it was a revelation. And it was one of those things where, you know, I thought I knew what I was doing, and I went down a road, and it's one of, you know, I'm very stubborn, I'm very kind of headstrong in my way, but when someone illuminates me, I will pursue their vision with all the fervor I would my own, just because it's right and it's the best thing for the company.
I agree. And it's funny. I mean, I've had exactly the same experiences where you think, well, you know, I'm a pretty dab hand at creating logos. And, you know, you do this and you put that logo and you think that's pretty good. And then you send it to someone that actually knows what they're doing. And you realize that you're tapping into the most incredible, uncharted, real talent. And you have maybe one tiny drop of what they have.
Right.
And, sure, and when you see the work, you actually feel slightly embarrassed that you actually even attempted to, you know. So is that advice? So look, just don't try and be, excuse the pun, but don't try and be a jack of all trades.
Absolutely. I mean, you kind of have to be to an extent. And, well, you know, it's funny because being an entrepreneur is very much like being an orchestra conductor. It's almost the only transferable skill. You know, as an orchestra conductor, you don't play the flute, you don't play the oboe, you don't play the cello, but you're kind of, you know enough about them to do a lot of damage, but you know enough about them to draw out what you need from them, from the players, but you're kind of removed a bit. You know, I'm not in the metal shops welding the stuff together. I'm not the artist designing everything, but I know what I want, and I know how to best bring it out from people. So it's an interesting skill set where I always think it's like Google Maps, where you kind of zoom way out, and then sometimes you have to move all the way in, and now you see, okay, now we're in there with the accountant going over the, you know, whatever, and then, okay, now we're back out and kind of monitor the whole thing again, which is what you do as a conductor. And it's fun for that. And I will say, part of why I wanted to do a lot of this stuff myself is I am a bit of an expert phobe, just because I think certainty is dangerous. And so that's why, you know, you talk to 16 different manufacturers, they've got 25 different opinions on it. And you kind of have to synthesize yourself as a kind of more detached founder. But you, there's people who are well-credentialed and so forth, but don't really know what they're talking about. And so part of the art is filtering those people from the real geniuses. I mean, the guys who help me with my branding, these guys are masters, you know.
But you appreciate that, but you can spot that. And again, the key phrase that you use is it is art. I really believe that entrepreneurialism is an art form. It is the ability to, as you say, to zoom in and zoom out. The trouble is you do tend to get caught up in details, as it were, when sometimes, and this comes with experience, and it comes with the more things that you do, you're able to say, well, okay, my strengths are here, but these guys, I know that these guys can really add to my overall ideas with their ideas.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's kind of funny. Where we are now with the companies, and as we're looking to do larger raises, I'm looking forward to bringing on, you know, I've sort of proven to myself what I need to prove, and I've learned enough of, you know, like learning orchestration. I've learned how the flute works. I've learned how the oboe works. I've learned how marketing works. I've learned how logistics work, that I can back off a bit and become more of a conductor with an ace team. An old friend of mine, he's a film director. And, you know, before he became a director, he was like 55 when he started directing, but he worked every single job on the set. He could do focus pulling. He was a gaffer. He did lighting. He did every editing, every little thing. So now as a director, you know, no one's pulling anything on him. You know, he could do everyone's job on the set, and they respect that, of course. But also, it's great for him to really have not be too aloof and too detached from the company. And that's kind of, I think, what I want for myself. Again, you do meet founders who are kind of, you know, clueless, I guess, and they have a great idea.
It's the ability that you have to say, well, I know enough to know that this is the guy that I need, as opposed to saying, you know, I need to bring in an economist, because, you know, when you say the word economist, I fall asleep. So that's I think that is a terrible thing to be able to say, look, I know nothing about this. But what you did is you create a baseline. You know, you find out about it, so you know just enough to know.
Just enough to know what you don't know. And you're right, it is an art. You have to know when it's time for that. And, you know, like, I don't like paint by numbers stuff in general, but sometimes, you know, it's right to put it into a formula. When do you do paint by numbers and just kind of plug it into a formula? And when do you, you know, look at it creatively, look at it in with real time and so forth? And how do you balance that? When do you do what? It's not just a rule book, you know?
So what's next? Is there another product in the back? I know you're just about to rule the world with Cocoa Jacks, but did you now feel, have you got a... First. Is it a bit of a drug? What are you going? Okay, we've got Cocoa Jack, that's sorted. We've got the design team, the marketing, the money.
Right.
Feel your wings unfurling.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have other companies I'd like to start. I do want to see how far Cocoa Jack I can take it before I commit too much to, you know, whatever else. But yeah, I mean, inventions, maybe, maybe not. There's some other companies. I can't tell you a couple of the ideas I have. They're really cool, but I can't tell you yet. You know, and I'd love to at some point own a restaurant, just because... it's a great way to lose money. You know, when you can use all kinds of ways to lose money, but starting a restaurant's one of the best and most delicious. And, but it's a great communal experience, and it's really important for,
I think aviation is as well, isn't it? What do they say in aviation? If you want to make a small fortune, start with a large one.
Yeah, right. There's no better way than owning an airplane. Yeah. It's like it's a money pit house with turbine engines or whatever.
And just, I mean, for those of you again that are listening, Dave is sitting in an Airstream RV, because you don't actually own any bricks and mortar. You have four RVs across the country. You have a private pilot's license. You fly. This is the life of the digital nomad.
Yeah. Well, and it's true. My setup, if I were a programmer, it would be more intuitive, I think, but I still set up this company that can all be run remotely for the most part. You know, if I have to go to FedEx or the UPS store to, you know, pick up a package or fax something, you know, once a year, I can do that. But by and large, you know, as long as I have a cell phone connection, I can run the company from anywhere, and I can work with my team who's all over the world remotely. And it's, you know, there's pluses and minuses to everything. I mean, it certainly is nice to see people face to face every day and have the normal, consistent business hours. But when you're a lean startup, it's a really bad use of your time. I mean, a friend of mine is working with a guy who's got, he's just started, but he's paying $7,000 a month for office space, and he doesn't even have a product yet. And I was thinking, well, you know, I mean, if you've got the funds, fine, you know, but if you're lean and you want to be disciplined, I mean, cut the fat, you know, before you have to grow it, you know, and our overhead is incredibly low. And even as we scale, you know, we just did a pro forma, even if we scale, our overhead is going to stay consistently low because we don't need that much, you know.
But you're living the dream as well. So, I mean, you can move, you can go wherever you want. You're not tied down. You're creating. Yeah. It is everything that is the dream of the entrepreneur, the ability to literally do whatever you want, wherever you want, whenever you want.
But at the same
time, have that focus and determination and skill to create this business and to shepherd the people around you.
So, I think you have to have a bit of self-discipline. I mean, I have quite a strong amount of self-discipline, so I can have chaos around me and not get sort of swept up in it. And I think that's, important. I mean, irregularity in working in a different city every day or a different coffee shop or a different hotel, wherever I am, I have the mental focus to kind of manage that, and it works really well for me. But, it's great because, I've got calls to Australia that don't start till 10 p.m., stuff with China that's, 5 or 6 p.m. or first thing in the morning and so forth. And then I've got, the normal day here, East Coast stuff. So having a 9-to-5 office hours for me wouldn't make any sense, so this actually complements really well.
I don't think it makes sense for anybody actually, but that's one of the great things.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, it's one of the hard things in office. Some people love that, I'm told. And it's one, as I scale, I'm going to have to be bringing in more people who that's their world. And it's a challenge for entrepreneurs to understand that mindset, because we're just not like that. The idea of, you're right, 9-to-5 every day, I would go out of my mind. But a lot of people really like that, I'm told. And so I have to learn how to interface with that.
But you're right. Exactly. But again, yeah. I mean, you're the creator, the voice, the personality, the charisma behind your product. So that's, I think it all adds to the story. It all adds to this, you're the shining light for entrepreneurs. Honestly, because you have everything. We all dream of the flexibility, the freedom that you embody. So it's wonderful.
Sure, that's good. Yeah, no, I mean, it can be done. I mean, you have to set it up properly, but I mean, the world is, I mean, this, we live in the future. This wasn't possible 10 years ago, maybe 20. I mean, it was possible, much more difficult. But there's so many entrepreneurs doing everything from fulfillment to, the guy who does my Amazon stuff. He's an entrepreneur. He runs his own company. He's not just some flunky, And, working with him, he brings an entrepreneurial dedication to it that, a 9-to-5 guy wouldn't necessarily. And there's entrepreneurs doing everything. Yes. And it's very atomized in a way, which I think freaks a lot of people out. People are used to centralization, but it's so atomized that it's incredibly nimble. It's like modular furniture or whatever. You can put it any which way you like. And all the components you need for a business today, they're out there and they're out everywhere and they're non-local. And it makes it much, in terms of those questions about your startup costs. Yeah, I mean, depending what your business is, but your startup costs can be incredibly low now, in terms of what you need to get stuff done.
But the parallels to what you're doing with music, all I can see is you as a conductor and this massive distributed business orchestra, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar. I mean, it's similar and it's different in that well, no, it's not. You're right. I mean, you're all in one place. The centralized mind of the thing and the direction thing comes from the conductor, the sort of font of the decision-making, just like a director in a movie set. But there is a great sprawling mass of people in front of you. And now I have the same sprawling mass of people that is all over the world. And I haven't met most of them, it's the technology allows that now. And it's possible, with music to, I think, engage the non-locality of it and the technology of it more. I'll see... I don't like to, it's funny, I don't like making plans anymore because everything changes every minute. So I kind of focus on what's right in front of me most of the time. But, I can see how if I started looking at music differently, given the world now, given the technology now, the options, if you open your mind to it, are staggering. I think that the education models and the kind of economic models around classical music, at least, make it very, very resistant to change. They make change not really rewarded. So there are ways around that as well. I think I've been thinking.
What I meant was that the businesses you have there are so many parallels with. It's like you're what you did in the past, but where your orchestra was in front of you. You're still conducting, but it's a business. At a distance, as opposed to, that same skill set. It's that same having the vision,
weird.
Articulating the vision, getting someone here to do the marketing, someone to do the branding, someone to do the.
Right. It's funny. For a long time, I felt after between careers, I was like, well, what skills do I have? It's one of the reasons I became a pilot. I was like, I want to be able to do something. But in a way, this is it's a skill set. It doesn't look like one. It's not like being a welder or being a painter or whatever. But being able to manage it, certainly psychologically, being able to balance all the things going on and live within certainly the chaos and be comfortable with the uncertainty. I think that's another one of the things. If I'm very, very happy having no idea what's going to happen tomorrow or today or 10 minutes from now. And learning that and trusting and having, I guess, the kind of faith or kind of confidence. It's a kind of just like things work, you know. And if you know that, you're able to see the right ring to grasp. You're able to see the step, like that Indiana Jones movie from a zillion years ago. You see the step kind of showing up in front of you when it's time to take it. Instead of needing to know 4 years in advance where you're going to be in, you know, 2013 and how, you know, what clothes you're wearing and what your hat looks like and, you know, who you're married to and all that sort of stuff. It's extremely present focused. It's extremely just like, here I am today. And most people, I think, just do not want that. And I think,
no, you're right, because it's very easy to say, I can't do anything because I haven't planned enough. But, you know, what is the expression, you know, if you want to be, do.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah, there's a guy named Isaac Morehouse who runs an entrepreneur sort of theater company. This is a little plug for Isaac called Praxis. And they basically, it's not even a school. It's like they bring in these guys and they teach them how to be entrepreneurs by just doing stuff and apprenticing and learning. And he's very much a proponent of, you know, don't plan, just do it and you'll screw it up, guaranteed, you know. And that's how you learn things. You learn 10 times more by doing something and figuring it out and making mistakes and figuring it out than you ever will learn by reading about it or watching somebody else make a mistake from a safe distance. It's dangerous. It's absolutely dangerous. You get muddy, you get dirty, you get emotionally hurt, you get injured, you have to change your thinking. You know, it's brutal, but I don't know. It infuses you with something that's much more vital than the kind of spectator sport life attitude that I think most people don't really want, but something in them makes them do it, you know. Yes. And it's they say they don't. I empathize because I was in between stuff for a while as well, and it's not always the right time to do things. But the entrepreneurial mindset, that's why I think it's so important for everything, no matter what you do, to think of it that way, with just sort of get in and do it. And that's, you know, here I am now, I know all this stuff, you know. I didn't know. I mentor some people, and I remember talking to some people and thinking, wow.
I know, but you go in thinking, well, I don't know anything, you know, but then you start talking, you think, well, I know a lot more than these guys do.
Yeah, that's what it is. And, you know, it's always relative to whoever's above you. There's plenty of people I learn from who know a lot more than I do. And, you know, I'm not going to be mentoring Bill Gates on how to build computers, but it's or software. But, you know, the people, you know, who you see, they're you know, wet behind the ears, or the expression is. And there's stuff that I can definitely, look at this way. You know, I'm, I don't believe I really know anything, that I wouldn't ever follow my advice, because I just don't know, you know, the million things that are influencing your life. I only know like one or two of them. So I can't really know things the way you know for your business, but still I can sort of guide and say, here's what happened for me and here's what I've learned. And it's really, it's true. It's amazing. Looking back, I mean, it's like 100 MBAs just by throwing myself into this and banging my head against the wall. And I mean, the stuff I've learned, it's priceless. And there's no other way to learn it.
I agree. I don't think you can. I think you can teach a certain amount, but I think there comes a point, again, using the aviation metaphor, you know, there comes a point when you have to fly the aircraft yourself.
Right. No one's going to land it for you. And if you can't land it, you know, I mean, the risk is obviously very, if you can't land the plane, you're going to wind up in the hospital, but it's, or you could.
Unless you have a very large amount of fuel, of course.
Well, you never have to come down, get refuel midair. Yeah, I guess that's a good point. It's expensive play, but yeah, no, exactly. It's, but that's putting yourself into it. I think it's very scary. And if you're willing to get hurt, because you will, and willing to scar over and grow from it, you'll be a beast on the far side of it. And the things that bothered me, when I used to get trolled on Facebook when we first launched, you know, we got all kinds of, this is the dumbest thing ever, this is so stupid, da, 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 you know, all this sort of stuff. I would write, like, why is this so expensive, or why is this so whatever? And I would write like 5 or 10 paragraph emails to people just explaining, and we're only 2 weeks old and we're really trying, and just like, yeah. It was like everything was so personal, you know? And I mean, I'm not saying I like being trolled now, but it's like the amount of shit I've put up with, from just rudeness, hostility, envy, sabotage, theft, extortion, you know, it's on and on and on. It's just the stuff that falls off my back now, I'm amazed, actually. It's not even a thick skin. It's just like a oily duck skin. This thing's like,
that's right,
doesn't bother me. Yeah, it probably comes from, not sharing it up, but yeah, I know
it's growth. It's the sort of growth that you never expected, but.
Right. No, you can't imagine, but you come out, I mean, the person I am now, it's like, I'm not, I'm probably not as good of a person as I was a few years ago, but I'm more of a, I mean, I'm impressed. It sounds lame, but I'm impressed with what I've had to become.
Yeah.
And it's not in a kind of like egoic way, but just like, wow, you know, that's, I didn't know it would be that hard. And I would know what it, like, it's like putting yourself through a crucible. You know, you just come at their side, you're cooked. And you're transformed, and that's exactly what it's been, this business.
But it's the beginning. But it's a constant evolution. You're not at the point now where you're just beginning. Every step,
yeah,
pushing through another, yeah, crucible with. But every now and then you get the cold shower just to sort of, you know.
Yeah, well, and that's a nice thing too. It's one of the entrepreneurial things I like to teach, is just failure. When you're an entrepreneur, you can choose when you're done. You can choose what success is. You can redefine success as you see fit. Failure, by definition, is not living up to somebody else's preferences for you. Oh, you didn't do this according to my schedule, or you didn't get the answer that I wanted on the test, or so forth. You're basically subjecting yourself to somebody else's assessment of what's important to them and the time frame that's important to them. So it's very easy to fail when the determination is not up to you. But as an entrepreneur, you kind of take that back onto yourself. And I mean, before I launched, one of my friends/mentors was telling me a story about someone who started some kind of online company where she wanted to sell dog treats or something like that. And they had this cool dog treat thing, and it wasn't working. And she kept persevering. They said pivot or persevere, and pivoted to something else, and moved a little bit this way, and moved a little bit this way. And after like 2 or 3 years, she was selling like, you know, custom made tennis balls with a $200,000 a year EBITDA, and you know, she was making a lot of money. And it wasn't what she thought, you know, going into it, but she didn't say, oh, well, I can't make the dog treats, I give up, you know, or she can. And then you take the knowledge you did with your quote unquote failed dog treat business, and you mentor other people, or you apply to something else and so forth. So you get to define your terms as an entrepreneur, which it sounds a little bit like a cop out, or it could if you're in that other mindset, but actually that's the entrepreneurial mindset, is you take with whatever you have in front of you and you create with it. The most sought after people in Silicon Valley, I'm told, I'm not in tech, are the people who failed at 3 or 4 businesses, because they've learned, they know everything. They know, yes, every pitfall to walk. Everyone can't wait to talk to them. I mean, yeah, it's great to talk to Steve Jobs, you know, he was alive, but he's not going to tell you the same thing as some guy who's had made every mistake you can imagine. That's invaluable. And that's also a 6-figure consulting business. So yes, there you go. That's your pivot.
And the pivot is really just realizing that the idea you had at the beginning, sometimes you have to let go and realize that actually the whole universe is telling me that I've got something, but I need to tweak it slightly. So I think one of the big failures that people make is hanging on to stuff for too long, when the entire universe is saying, you know, just tweak it slightly.
Yep. It's being flexible. And it's that's the art of it, is there's no prefab plan. You can write out your 5-year plan. You know, it didn't work for Stalin, and it's not
quite smart.
Right, he was a smart guy, lots of good advisors, great education, but you know, it's not going to work for you either, because you have to be really present. And that's where all the California New Age stuff actually can work and be. It's being present with what is. It's very Buddhist in a way, but it's practical Buddhism, you know, or practical New Ageism, where you're not, oh, is this? What about that? Or, well, this is what I used to do. That's going to work today. It's like, I talk to a lot of investors who they made their money 10 or 20 years ago, and they know how to make money in 1995 or 1999. And they're right, and it worked for them, and I couldn't for a second disparage that. But you also meet people where it's like, it's not 1999 anymore. Yeah. You know, there were no Facebook ads in 1999. There were no, you know, Shipwire fulfillment houses in 1999. There was no internet basically in 1999. And so the world is so completely different. If you're looking at it through prefab eyes, you're going to miss what's going on. So it's being relentlessly present oriented with, here's where things are now. And they're always going to change. And it's an art. It's an art, and it's an outlook, and it's fun. And it's very different from the way most of us were raised, where there's a right answer and a wrong answer. The goal is to get the right answer. It's already known what the right answer is by somebody else, and you have to figure out what they're thinking. And that's a way of thinking that is, I think, just toxic for certainly for entrepreneurship, but even just for living your life. You know, yeah, life is the same way. You know, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, and how do you make lemonade out of whatever life gives you, whether it's oranges or lemons or whatever? You know, how do you manage the they say, I grew up playing chess, which is very much in that other model. And I read somewhere where it's like, well, life isn't chess, or entrepreneurship isn't chess. It's more like Tetris,
yes.
You know, where stuff is flying at you every which way. And okay, well, that kind of worked. Okay, put that one over here, you know, and it's imperfect, but it's a scramble to make on the fly adjustments to what's really happening in real time. It's very, very, very different than the way most of us were raised. And so a lot of it.
It's intoxicating at the same time. And as you say, you know, could you ever go back? Could you ever go back to being employed or?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was talking to other entrepreneurs. He's like, well, I'm basically unemployable. And not because I'm stupid or uneducated or unskilled, but it's like, you don't want to hire me, you know,
because, right.
Because it's just, it would be too much, you know? But it's, yeah, I can't, I mean, it's, yeah, once you're in it, you're right. It's just a way of thinking. But you also know that you can sort of make something out of anything. You wake up one day and here's what's in front of me, and boom, you can make something out of nothing. You know,
exactly.
And that's a nice sense of yourself and your life, that you know you can make something out of nothing, and not just a product, but an idea, a company, a revenue stream, whatever. And it's a very exciting way to live. You know.
I've got some other questions for you now, leading on from that piece of fantastic advice and inspiration. So now it's time for my 10 questions. I hope you're prepared for these, because these will open up the floodgates. I've created a new word there, floodgate. You can use
floodgate. Yeah.
Floodgate.
Sure.
So my first question from the questionnaire that I borrowed from James Lipton, thanks again, James, is, Dave Goodman, what is your favorite word?
Mellifluous in English.
Mellifluous.
I sort of forget what it means, but it's got a great mouthfeel to it. It's like honey, what is it? Mellow is from honey, and fluous is whatever. I used to be I actually sort of speak four languages, and I was kind of a language buff when I was more of a scholar. My favorite word is in German is innig. It's like this sort of inwardness. I think it's very beautiful. We don't really have a compliment in English, but innig.
You do realize you're the only person that's ever answered this question in four separate languages.
Yeah.
I must add a piece. So in one language, what is your favorite? Okay. My second question.
Yeah, right.
What is your least favorite word? And you may use a choice of Arabic, Hindu,
Man, yeah. And I'm looking at because I did take notes on this, because I was thinking about it all last night. And my notes are empty on that. My least favorite word. Let's do that one.
Exactly. It's that whole, I think it means won't. Is it that sort of interpretation?
Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah. If you won't, you can't. If you can't, you won't. But it's the opposite of what Henry Ford said or whatever. If you think you can, or you think you can't, you're right. You know, and I think can't is just when people tell me that's not possible, it's, you know, okay. You know, it's, it irks me.
Yeah. And it's a very common, answer. So, what are you most excited about right now?
Right now, raising capital. I had a revelation about raising capital, which I won't share now. It was sort of personal about 2 weeks ago, and it just changed my whole worldview. Very exciting.
Friends. And what turns you off right now?
Well, it's the complacency and knowledge. I hate to say it sounds strange, but I find ignorance to be much more useful than knowledge.
Yeah, well, they say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
And that's all we ever have. Yeah, it's no one. What we don't know is literally infinite, and what we know is finite. So I think humility is appropriate.
That's great.
That's my feeling about that.
So what sound or noise do you love?
Cranking.
You are looking at your notes, aren't you?
I totally am. No, I prefer like Shark Tank, except
yeah, exactly.
A little less pressure, you know. But if you give me the cheat questions, then I'll definitely research them. I'll think about them. The class musician in me, so I guess I do plan sometimes. The sound of my RV starting that, and just it's just no. Okay, it works today. We're off. That's I love that.
So that's not even a certainty. So in other words, will it start? So that's the thing.
No. If I leave the wrong thing plugged in overnight and it just clicks, I'm like, I've got to call AAA or something. And hopefully I haven't overrun my AAA subscription. So yeah.
There's a great scene in Breaking Bad where the RV breaks down in the middle of the desert.
Okay.
So I immediately thought of that. So my next question is, what sound or noise do you hate? Is it the click?
That just means it's a new adventure. I plug in my inverter to plug my phone and my computer into the RV. There's a little inverter you plug in the cigarette lighter, and it's got this fan on it that whirs. And I get it. Sometimes it has to cool off the thing, but it whirs for no reason, which to me, I think that's what irks me. It sort of whirs, even though it's not like plugged in, it still cools itself off, even if it's not getting hotter. And that's like those complacent people who just kind of do the same thing over again because that's what they do. It just whirs and it's this horrible noise that I can't relax around. So
that's amazing. So which leads on to my next question. What is your favorite curse word?
Right. And I'm so glad I can finally do a show where I can curse. I was on Ken's show and I had to sort of muzzle myself the whole time. This one is actually in French, Saint-Fichier, which is like, that makes me shit, which I think is just funny.
What is it again?
Some fichier, that makes me shit. I mean, I don't know if they still say that, but when I was spending time in France, they would put them out some fichier, and they were just sort of always, you know, cursing about something because that's what you do in France, I think. And I would translate into English, and I was like, wow, that makes me shit. I can't imagine that being a very
But the great thing about cursing in the U.S. in French is people say, "What did you say, Dave?" You say, "I think it's brilliant." people will not know the translation of.
That's good.
So it is. It's a stealth curse word, which is just brilliant.
We have a lot in English. One of my Russian friends said there's all these curse words in Russian that only the sailors use. I'm like, where do I find those out? You know, we've got like two curse words, it's fucking and shitting. And, you know, they're not, you know, that's all I know. I mean, so that's kind of boring. No, I mean, am I wrong?
This is a whole new business, I think, just to educate people how to swear effectively.
Wow, no kidding. Yeah, I think there are books about that, how to swear, and because it's the certainly Russian, I'm sure they've got some good ones. That's
right. So what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Many, and I don't like the word attempt, so I'll just edit that out. But there's that don't do or try or do or whatever thing.
As I said at the beginning, Dave, this is not my questionnaire. I'm merely
borrowing. I will not. Then you'll be offended when I cross.
I'll send you James Lipton's email address if you want to complain to him. But don't shoot the message.
I'll let him know. I mean, I'd like. It sounds horrible. No, it's not. I would love to do a talk radio show. Oh, that would be fun.
I think you'd be brilliant at it. Absolutely.
Thank you. That would be fun. I like yelling a lot. But I can be entertainingly obnoxious, I think, if given the right circumstances. I think that's
a good Howard Stern-ish or?
Probably not entertainment. More, probably would start around economics and then morph into darker topics, I think. I have a lot of colorful interests that it's fun to kind of morph together.
Oh, brilliant. Well, can't wait for that. Heard it first here, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, that'll be our next interview for that'll be a freaky one. Yeah.
So what profession would you not like to attempt? Again, apologies for the word attempt.
Well, we hit anything that involves working for other people, and I'm just killing myself for any future prospects. But I think that's almost all of them. TSA, I wouldn't want to do that. Definitely the TSA. I always opt out for the pat downs, and I hate it, and they hate it too. And it's
that's a tough job. I guess it's just tough jobs, really, isn't it? Because you're working in this really, it's the antithesis of what you're doing. It's rules, regulations, layers, hierarchies.
Yeah, hierarchies and fruitlessness, and there's a natural chafing against inefficiencies where you just do things because that's what you do. And you have to set up corporations to an extent like that. You just do the rules, but you're not actually. You do so because that's what you're supposed to do, and that's what you have to do, not because it makes any sense.
Yes.
And that just my intellect. It hurts my intellect. Even I've learned to accept that's a lot of life. Just it's more efficient to do it that way than to try to actually be present with what you're doing. For most people, I guess, but I would have a hard time doing that.
So my final question then is: if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Are you sure you're done? That would be mine for that. Too esoteric? Okay.
No. I mean, come on. We're talking about God, which is rather esoteric generally.
Yeah, that's pretty esoteric anyway. So yeah, that's my speculative answer.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. Well, Dave, how do people get hold of you? How do they find out about the Coco Jack and everything that you're doing?
Sure, you can email for now. Just email me. Or
how do they troll you, for example? Because it sounds like you haven't been trolled for ages.
I was going to say, I don't want to put out this Jack at coco-jack.com. So our website is coco-jack.com because that guy in New Zealand is still sitting on Coco Jack. coco-jack.com and Jack at coco-jack.com. will eventually get to me, but don't put anything personal in there because I won't read it the first time. So it'll get sent to me. But that's how you can find us. And you can learn more about the company at coco-jack.com. You can purchase tools there. And we'll do a little, let's use Matthew as a 10% discount code. We'll set that up just for your listeners.
Oh, and, fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. Or we can, anything you like. That's just the, I usually do first name because it's easy to remember. And yeah, that's, just keep an eye. We'll be around.
Brilliant, Dave. Well, thank you so much. It's been amazing talking to you. It's been so exciting to have you on the show. And I you know, can't wait to follow your progress.
Cheers. This was so much fun. Thanks for the steering wheel. Thanks for the invite. This was great.